From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor for Newsweek, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The impeachment inquiry into President Trump is accelerating with dramatic developments on several fronts. An election is set in Britain with the future of both Brexit and Prime Minister Boris Johnson on the line, and Facebook under fire. We'll talk about the social media giant. There are growing calls in both the U.S. and Europe for some sort of crackdown. Well, let's start, Jonathan and Kimberly, with this impeachment inquiry into President Trump, accelerating rapidly here in the United States. And just this week, the Democrats who control the House of Representatives passed some rules that will take all of this into the next phase, a very public phase that Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, says is designed to sort of let the American public see what the evidence is that's being accumulated against President Trump. This is almost exactly a totally partisan vote on both sides. Sum up for us what happened this week, Kimberly.
So that was a really pivotal moment in this ongoing impeachment inquiry, because one of the main Republican arguments against this inquiry thus far, which I should say is not the actual impeachment that may come later depending on how this goes, was that the process was flawed. Now, the process had been going as previous impeachment inquiries had gone, where various committees in the House of Representatives were interviewing witnesses and things like this. But this formal vote on this process and the rules around it kind of take the wind out of that argument for Republicans, and also for the Democrats kind of identify who's going to do what. It identifies which committee heads are going to be doing what and what rights the Republicans have in terms of bringing in witnesses. In addition, it also gives more clarity to what the president and his legal team can do.
Kimberly made a good point when she said that the Republicans, Jonathan, for the longest time have said, look, there's no transparency to this. It's a sham. It's a witch hunt, whatever phrase they want to use. Well, now all of this is going to be out in the open, and the Republicans, for the first time, are going to have to talk about not the process that they've been attacking, but the facts and the substance and the evidence that has been accumulated against the president. That's a very stark change.
Yes. As Kimberly said, they were focusing only on process up until now. But now that argument has been taken away from them, or that point has been taken away from them, by the fact that this is now going into the public phase of this inquiry. A strategy seems to be developing where the Republicans, both in Congress and the White House, are essentially saying that what the president did was perfectly fine, that what he was really asking the Ukrainians to do was to look into corruption and to make sure that American aid dollars to Ukraine are being spent wisely. So they're trying to broaden the issue away from a specific request to look into Trump's political enemies or political rivals and to make it an issue of corruption.
Well, another argument you're starting to hear is this narrative that the Democrats are trying to undermine the democracy by pushing this in an inquiry and potentially articles of impeachment and a case in the Senate, which is where it would go, that would overlap an election campaign and happen in an election year. And so now you're also seeing this, oh, they just don't want the American people to vote, and so they're trying to remove that opportunity. That narrative is being sort of tested out in early phases at this point as well. But I think you are having seen the Republicans struggle a great deal to make these arguments on the facts of the matter, because as more and more, in the case of this week, sometimes sitting White House officials are coming in and corroborating some of the more serious allegations that are out there, it's making it much harder for the Republicans to go against the facts.
And on that point, let's talk briefly about some of these charges that are coming out. There's really sort of a flood of big names testifying on the Hill before Congress about what the president is accused of doing. A couple of people saying, look, there was a quid pro quo. Either I heard it or I was briefed on it. Another gentleman for military aid said that they clearly tried to doctor the transcript of the call between the president and Mr. Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. And President Trump is always saying, well, look at the transcript. There's nothing at the transcript that indicates that there was a quid pro quo or anything wrong. And these guys say, well, that's because they doctored the transcript. They left out key things that they didn't want in there. So
it does say the transcript is not actually a transcript on document.
That's right. So that appears, that to me sounds like a bit of a cover-up.
Yes. And what's happening here is that the witnesses that are coming in, that are testifying, are virtually impeachable. I mean, one of them was a lieutenant colonel, an immigrant from the Ukraine, who has devoted his entire professional life to service for the United States. And he's the one who actually listened in on the phone call and corroborated exactly what the whistleblower initially said. So what you see now is President Trump calling him a never-Trumper, essentially trying to smear his reputation, which I think makes the administration look very, very bad.
Just to give our listeners a little background, you're talking about a gentleman named Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. He's a Ukraine expert on the National Security Council. And to your point, he served in Iraq, served in Afghanistan, and he...
And was wounded in
Iraq. It has been reported, Purple Heart winner for being wounded in combat. And to this day, CNN has reported, still has shrapnel in his body from that combat. It's awfully hard to attack the patriotism of someone who has that kind of record.
It's worth noting both Republican and Democrat members of Congress quickly came out after the president's criticisms of him in his defense.
Anybody who says something that is even remotely critical of him while he's an ever-Trumper or he's just working on behalf of some other country or something like that, I mean, open, honest criticism, he just seems to chafe at no matter from what quarter it comes.
Yes, exactly. And there were other witnesses that came forward and testified this week who basically, again, corroborated exactly what the whistleblower said. And I think one of the reasons why this impeachment inquiry is moving into this public phase is because the Democrats now feel confident with this kind of testimony from witnesses that they can make a compelling case.
It's interesting also that these charges that are slowly but surely being compiled by the Democrats in the House, it concerns more than this Ukraine situation and this alleged quid pro quo. You might remember the Mueller report from a couple of months ago. The president says, well, no obstruction, no collusion. Of course, that's not true because the Mueller report listed at least 10 allegations of obstruction. Those have not gone away. And you can be sure, Kimberly, that they're going to be taking a closer look at all of that, too.
Right. And what was hidden, what was moved around in order to potentially protect the president from further investigation. Mueller, when he finished his report and when he was sort of dragged in front of Congress against his will to testify, his point was that he was not absolving the president of anything, but it was not his role to criminally prosecute the president of the United States. That was his interpretation of the law, was that that was not something he could do. He's like, here's what I found. You're Congress. It's your job. Do with it what you want. So we will probably see more of that bubbling back to the surface, especially as it relates to efforts by people within the Trump administration to try to suppress information or potentially if they have lied to Congress.
Now, so it's not just Ukraine stuff, but it could be just a long list of charges that the president conceivably could face here. What happens next year, Jonathan, in this process, and what's sort of the timeline attached to it?
What happens is that the hearings that are going on the Hill, which had been closed, they will now be open. The Intelligence Committee will hold public hearings and witnesses will come forward. The American people will get to hear what they have to say. Many of these witnesses have already testified, so we know essentially what they're going to say, but their remarks have come out through the media and through leaks. Now the public will get a chance to actually hear with their own ears what they've been saying behind closed doors.
Without being filtered by the media.
Exactly. And then what will happen is that all of this information that has come out will then be given over to the Judiciary Committee, the House Judiciary Committee, which on the basis of what they hear and what the president and his lawyers argue in their own defense and what Republicans say in their questioning of these witnesses, on the basis of that, that will be turned over to the Judiciary Committee. And then the Judiciary Committee will decide whether they're going to write articles of impeachment. They hope to have this wrapped up in terms of a timeline by Thanksgiving.
which is just less than a month away.
Less than a month away. So it's a very, very fast-track process. It's not clear that they'll actually get things done by then, but that is the goal.
Now, beyond that, Kimberly, sort of the political ramifications of this were the 2020 campaign is well underway, a whole bunch of Democrats still in the race here, and the conventional wisdom, I'm often skeptical of that, but the conventional wisdom is that Republicans say, well, this is going to galvanize President Trump. They've been raising a bunch of money off of this, and it will sort of anger Republicans to go to the polls. Why wouldn't this also galvanize Democrats who don't like the president?
I think the Democrats who don't like the president are already as galvanized as they're going to be for a litany of other things done by the Trump administration that upsets Democrats, whether it be his actions on immigration or lack of actions related to climate change, health care, pick your issue. There are plenty of reasons for Democrats to be angry at the president. The president is successfully using impeachment to really rally his base. They're selling witch hunt merchandise as campaign items. The other issue that this might bring into the 2020 campaign is just that it sucks up all the oxygen. This is at a moment when Democratic candidates are trying to get traction, trying to get their name out there, and all of the headlines aren't their latest campaign proposals, it's impeachment. And at the same time, you have candidates who are members of both the House of Representatives and senators who might potentially have to vote on articles of impeachment, and then they would have to be in Washington, not on the campaign trail.
What are the polls, either of you can answer this one, what are the polls in general saying about all of this?
The nationwide poll shows that there is a majority of Americans who favor impeachment and favor removal from office. However, within Trump's base, he is still very, very popular and very, very strong. So what it really boils down to is which particular states, what the polling numbers there show. I mean, there are roughly six or seven battleground states where the election will be decided. And what's very important is how the folks in those states feel about impeachment.
Yeah. Now, for folks listening quickly here, I mean, as Jonathan said, of the 50 states, the election is really going to come down to just a handful of them in places like Florida, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona, perhaps Virginia, those kind. All the other states, it's pretty much known based on current polls and also history, frankly, how most of these states are going to vote. So very interesting point. Let's pause for a short break. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor for Newsweek, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson won support for a snap election, the House of Commons voting overwhelmingly 438-20 to dissolve Parliament and launch a six-week election campaign. Imagine running a campaign in just 6 weeks. At stake here, Brexit, the three-year effort to leave the European Union. It's also a huge gamble for Johnson himself, of course, who puts his own job on the line. Now, he could go down in history, perhaps, depending on how this goes, as the prime minister who finally, two failed prime ministers were unable to do this, to take Britain out of the European Union, or become the shortest-serving prime minister, I think, in about two centuries. What's going to happen here?
Well, I think it's worth noting first that we're recording this the day after he swore up and down Britain was definitely going to exit the European Union. Of course, that did not happen. The EU granted an extension, which he didn't want to take, and the Parliament forced him to do it. It's all complicated. So now he's trying with this election to sort of garner more support, to prove that if the Conservatives conservatives can win even more seats, that he's got the backing to get out of Brexit the way that he wants to. I don't know. This thing just keeps repeating over and over again. Jonathan was saying earlier, it sounds like Groundhog's Day every time, which in the United States is a holiday we celebrate. We're, you know, anyway, it's a
same thing
reference.
Happens same every thing reference. Single day. Yeah.
Same thing happens every single day.
You said getting out of Brexit the way he wants to. What is the way he wants to?
I think what he wants is either some sort of deal that would keep the border between the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland open so that traffic and goods and people can cross that border without...
They're major trade partners, those two neighbors.
Yes, exactly. The Republic of Ireland is a member of the EU. If the United Kingdom pulls out, there's a border, a land border, between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland. So that is the only place where there's an actual land border between an EU country and a non-EU country, assuming that the UK pulls out.
And speaking of trade issues, President Trump, and we just can't stop talking about him, he sort of inserted himself into this earlier this week when he called into a radio show the head of the Brexit party and was saying that he'd actually didn't like the plan that Boris Johnson had for Brexit and that it was going to make it hard for the U.S. to do a trade deal with the U.K. under those terms. Now, why is that important? Because the whole argument for Brexit is that Britain will be better off economically on its own than from the EU. And that would be incredibly reliant on having a really good trade deal with the US. So for President Trump to sort of step in and say that this deal that Boris Johnson is pushing wouldn't be good for that could potentially be quite damaging to his campaign.
Yeah, it's interesting that President Trump, who claims to be friends with Prime Minister Johnson, did him no favors by calling in. I think it was Nigel Farage's radio show. So talk about getting involved in foreign elections.
This is a classic Trumpian move. I mean, when he sees that his potential interlocutor in any negotiation over a bilateral trade agreement between the United States and Britain, when he sees that that figure is essentially under pressure, on the ropes, going into an election where the results may be uncertain. In other words, he's weak. So what does Trump do? He plays his hand. He goes right in and he says, oh, this may not be the best thing. I'm going to add more pressure to you. So he, in this case, tries to strengthen his own hand, Trump's hand, in advance of any negotiation.
It's sort of the equivalent of like Boris Johnson phoning into a radio show here and saying something negative about the president. It was just kind of odd for him to do that.
I don't think it's quite the same because President Trump doesn't really rely on good trade deal with Boris Johnson for the future of his presidency. And so he definitely has a stronger negotiating position in this moment. And I think that he's really, as Jonathan said, playing to that.
It's interesting that this whole Brexit thing has been going on for about 3.5 years now. I mean, originally passed, I think, in the summer of 2016, very narrowly, about 52% now. And I wonder, what is the sort of number of Britons who now favor? They seem to be getting friends. I just got back from overseas, and friends there saying, well, we're just tired of the whole thing. I wish it would just, one way or another, just go away.
Well, one of the reasons why people believe that the election might be decisive in this case is because...
Decisive in favor of Johnson?
Of resolving the issue is because the conservatives are expected to win more seats. And if they do, as Kimberly said, they will leave the way Johnson prefers. However, if the Labour Party wins, if the public disgust or lack of excitement about this anymore, basically want to just get this thing off their plates, if the Labour Party wins, the Labour Party is banking their election chances on calling a second referendum, where the public would get to actually vote whether they want to leave the EU or not. In other words, a second go at it.
And it's worth noting that one of the reasons the Labour Party has been pushing for a second referendum for so long is this argument that the British public now has more information about what Brexit would actually mean in terms of economic impact, in terms of the challenges of working with the EU, the fact that the deal isn't as good as what was promised during the original campaign. And so this is their argument, that the British public did not get a full or honest picture about what Brexit would mean, and therefore we should have have a second referendum. Obviously, the pro-Brexiters disagree with that strongly.
One thing, as we before we move on here, that seems to be giving Johnson a boost, and polls, in fact, do show that he's likely to get his way in this election, and as you say, add more seats in the House of Commons, which will give him the leverage that he needs. It's probably helpful that his opponent, the Labour candidate Jeremy Corbyn, is not polling well. A lot of the proposals that he has put out, far left kind of things that, at least according to surveys there, are really putting off a lot of British voters who are nowhere near far to the left as he is.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Corbyn is not very popular. And if the polls are to be believed, then I think Johnson is going to win.
Well, let's move on here. Social media now plays a huge role in political campaigns, not just here in the United States, but elsewhere. Messages for or against a candidate or issue. The problem, of course, is that a lot of these messages are false and inflammatory, and platforms like Facebook and Twitter have come under fire for allowing such messages to proliferate and spread easily. Now, for this reason, Twitter just this week said that it would ban political advertising. Facebook, though, says it will continue to allow it. It's making a whole bunch of money off of this, claims such things are free speech, even though some of these ads are clearly not true. Kimberly, what do you think?
It's been just incredibly challenging for these big tech companies to walk this fine line between saying that they support free speech, but also saying that they want to clamp down on manipulating elections. Facebook is particularly sensitive to this, since, as we know from every single national security agency in the United States, the Russians very effectively used Facebook during the 2016 elections to sort of manipulate many American people. And so Facebook has come down on, you know what? Not our problem. We're just going to step back and let it play. We're going to go after state actors that are interfering in the elections of others, but we're not going to try to police what real candidates or real organizations or real people are saying, even if it's demonstrably false and even if it's spreading like wildfire. Twitter instead is taking the complete opposite stance, washing its hands of the whole thing in a different way and just saying, we're not going to allow it at all.
Yeah. If I just may add something here, although Facebook did come out with some policies going forward where they're actually going to allow whoever to put things up on Facebook, but what they're going to do is they're going to flag, as a result of their own fact checkers, advertisements or postings that are false.
Well, they claim to have hired some 35,000 people who, that's all they do, is try and sift through stuff and determine what's false and what's not false.
Right. And what happens, what you'll see on the Facebook page, is that the information will appear, but there'll be a very, very large gray square that basically says this is false information according to our fact checkers. Now, how effective that can be, I mean, you know, you can catch, it's just like smuggling drugs. I mean, you catch, what, 10% of the drugs coming into the country? It's the same way with speech.
It sounds like a warning on a cigarette box. These cigarettes are bad for you and people smoke them anyway.
Right.
Although cigarette smoking rates have declined since when these labels
That's
get
true.
Put on. So, but another thing that, as Jonathan was kind of alluding to, is the implementation of this is going to be extraordinarily challenging, both for Twitter and for Facebook. And these are companies that are already facing criticism from conservatives that their views are being suppressed unfairly on these platforms. President Trump has criticized Twitter's move, although Lindsey Graham apparently came out in support of it. He's a very high-ranking Republican member of Congress. And so at the end of the day, these are private companies deciding who gets to say what on their site. And that's always going to be controversial. And Twitter is going to find itself in particular danger if it opens itself up to the accusations that the ads it does allow end up being supportive of more liberal causes, and the ads that it really cracks down on are the ones that support conservative causes. Now, I should also mention the money angle of this. I think Twitter made, I don't know, maybe a couple dozen millions of dollars off these political ads. Facebook makes hundreds of millions of dollars off political ads. So the risk-reward balance is also different for the two companies.
It's interesting that sort of in this age of people not trusting media, Facebook is one thing that people do tend to trust because, as Kimberly said, who they follow, if you get something from your friend or family relative, you may be more inclined to believe it than before. We'll have to end it right there. Thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Jonathan Broder, he's contributing editor at Newsweek, and Kimberly Adams, she's the Washington correspondent for Marketplace. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer Joe Gill, and I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thanks for joining us.